My name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Kyle Merkins from Pro-Choice Resources, an organization in Minneapolis that provides reproductive health services. Kyle has worked on a sexual health and education training program called The Birds and the Bees, and he's now working to increase women's access to abortion and post-abortion counseling and support. A few years ago, Kyle was a clinic escort at the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo, North Dakota, which is the only abortion clinic in the state. In college, he participated in campus ministry, and he was raised in the Lutheran Church. So, Kyle, tell us about the work you do at Pro-Choice Resources on abortion and reproductive health. Do you work directly with women?
At Pro-Choice Resources, I manage the Abortion Assistance Fund, and so I'm talking with women on the phone every day who are seeking abortion services but are unable to access abortion because of financial barriers or concerns with travel. Sometimes it's related to childcare, maybe problems with medical assistance or Medicaid. Sometimes it's regarding things like health insurance, all kinds of different questions. The work that I do directly with women is, of course, kind of that short-term case management, but then I also do grants and loans of, you know, anywhere from $150 to $350.
Well, some people, and here I'll play devil's advocate a little bit, would say,
Well,
abortions should be hard to get. And, you know, why are you giving women money to get abortions? You know, that's the rhetoric on one side. But what is the reality that you confront in terms of women who are faced with this decision, who've decided that they can't continue a pregnancy?
That's, of course, a really common thing that we hear and a really common thing that's being kind of put out in the public. And I think ultimately that's a major concern that I have is sort of this this perception that somehow rareness of abortion is preferable to comprehensive access to full reproductive health services, or that somehow by making something go away or have less of, that we'll be actually addressing some sort of systemic problem. The same people that we're saying it should be hard to get to are the same people that we're saying you should be pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, which they may or may not have access to boots.
In terms of other services that women need, how comprehensive are those? So if a woman needs contraception so that she doesn't get pregnant in the first place, or needs childcare if she already has two kids and has a low-paying job, how do those other services fit into, or those other needs, I should say, fit into a woman's decision?
So, you know, someone who maybe, like you said, has two children, someone who is currently unemployed or maybe a student or maybe is in a situation where they don't have access to health care. When we add in these additional layers and when we approach kind of the intersections of where all these things come together, that's when we start to look more clearly at what it means to be focused on reproductive justice. If someone doesn't have $500 to pay for a first trimester abortion, or doesn't have access to credit cards, or doesn't have friends or family that are able to offer them any additional assistance, clearly there are other things in their life that they probably are also not going to be able to provide for. The ability to decide when someone wants to parent, the ability to decide if someone wants to parent, and the ability to decide under what conditions someone becomes pregnant and becomes a parent are actually human rights issues.
So, Kyle, you're a person of faith. You were raised in the Lutheran Church, and you work on abortion issues. And so, again, to just put my devil's advocate hat on for a minute, someone might say, well, if you're in a difficult situation, a woman should just pray for strength rather than kill that poor little baby. So, as a person of faith and as someone who is an advocate for women facing situations that are morally complicated, how do you fit the two together, issues of reproductive justice, issues of faith, in a way that may be morally complex but doesn't fit into the sort of, you know, black and white issues?
I think first and foremost, when I think about faith and when I think about the way that the church's foundations, the doctrinal sort of foundations of communities of faith and the messages of Jesus, ultimately, I think that that is about, you know, it's really about liberation and about freeing people who are facing oppression. But then I also think that in a more sort of nuanced way and kind of thinking more about the way that this conversation has been framed by both, really, frankly, by both sides on the issue, is really this kind of impulse to separate a person who's pregnant from a fetus. This whole idea that somehow we're pitting the rights of a fetus against the rights of the person who is carrying the fetus, I think it just really takes away from this sort of holistic look at the way that people make decisions, as though this person who is pregnant is not able to comprehend the needs of herself. We need to look more holistically at the picture and try to figure out how we can approach that in such a way that doesn't try to dictate morality, but to support someone in decision-making around themselves and around kind of the whole picture of their life.
And really, rather than being judgmental, to look inside our own hearts and realize that we all have faced complicated decisions in our life. And we have to ponder and discern and do some really hard work to figure out what to do. And we want to be trusted to do that work and not to be told what to do. And really, it's a matter of trusting women as well, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And I think that sometimes when we, you know, turn to make sweeping more moral decisions and values decisions kind of coming from one source, it does limit the potential of communities and of people, of families, and of, you know, smaller systems to approach morality and values and faith and how all those things kind of fit together in looking at a whole picture of someone's life.
Related to that, I want to ask you about some real-world work you did in Fargo, North Dakota, which has one clinic, the Red River Women's Clinic, and you were a clinic escort there. Why did you do that? And is there anything, I would think, can you fill in the blanks and tell us what it was really like?
So I escorted at the clinic for 1 year, and then I was on staff at the clinic for a couple of years. The hope was that by targeting the clinic through multiple national organizations that are working to protest outside of clinics and things like that, that they would somehow make North Dakota an abortion-free state, and that would, you know, win in some way by, you know, being out on the sidewalk and protesting against people who are entering the clinic. And ultimately, the escort is really sort of a response to that, ultimately providing a safe transport from a vehicle to the door of the clinic, because it's a lot of shame. It's a lot of people, you know, yelling or handing information, and a lot of them might be claiming to represent the same values and the same faith tradition, the same morality that you claim yourself. And I think that escorts provide a critical role in sort of acknowledging that actually there is support, too, and that there are people out here from all kinds of different walks of life who actually genuinely trust that you know what the best decision for yourself, and that we're just going to make sure that you're safe in getting into the clinic, and that we're going to make sure that that people who are outside kind of harassing and protesting have only limited access to the individuals who are walking into the clinic. You know, something about that experience for me was just really identifying how much kind of shame that has been trained into someone can just sort of flare up. But that this all coming right before you enter a clinic and are making a decision that likely has been made very difficult to you due to stigma, due to needing to be secretive. And I think that that is just such a really powerful, powerful moment, and is a really clear and direct way where someone can have a brief impact, but a really unmeasurable impact in someone's life, kind of on the front lines, if you will.
And so just to be clear, if this is, North Dakota is a big state, and this is just the only clinic in the state, so people may have traveled, women may have traveled long distances to get there. And as you say, maybe it's a woman who used to believe that abortion was morally wrong and she would never have one, and then found herself in a situation where, in fact, that becomes the best decision for her. So she's dealing with the hurdles of travel. She's dealing with the hurdles of shame. She's dealing with the hurdles of the morally complex decisions.
And that is, it's just a very, it's a very real thing. And so overcoming these hurdles and getting to that point to kind of experience this one final hurdle. And it's really difficult to see maybe some icons, crosses, things like that, that you maybe really identify with being used to represent a perception that what you're doing is wrong.
So I want to broaden the conversation a little bit to the birds and the bees, which is the sexuality education program that you've worked on. And one way to reduce the need for abortion is to promote comprehensive sexuality education and access to contraception. So what's your sense of whether kids today in schools are getting a healthy, comprehensive sexuality education program? And then also, in the education they're getting, do values and morality fit into the sexuality education?
You know, I think one of the things that we're really seeing as a trend in sexuality education is, you know, the impulse to focus on these comprehensive sexuality education curricula that are evaluated and evidence-based at reducing pregnancy and reducing STI transmission rates, which while those things are really very important, the work that of the sexuality education program at Pro-Choice Resources is really actually about exploring the things that traditional sexuality education curricula don't address. And that, I think, actually speaks really, really clearly to what to how values, morality, faith fit into sexuality education. Something that we have found is that a lot of the skills, a lot of the things that someone would need to negotiate sexual health, decision-making, are actually like some of the same skills that we really, really hold up as communities of faith too. You know, values and approaching building trust and who are trusted adults and healthy relationships and healthy decision-making. We kind of have these big pendulum swings, right, where we move towards abstinence only, we move towards comprehensive sexuality, and we go back and forth between those. I think something that we're really trying to address is kind of slicing through the middle of that. While a lot of people would probably disagree with that, we really, our sense is that, you know, training in these skills, training in these directions are actually really going to support young people in making the decisions that they know are right for themselves as well, which relates right back into the work that we do with women and in the work that we do to try to, you know, support people in making the decisions that they know are best for themselves.
So talk a little bit, you're a millennial and you've talked about a distinctive way of looking or viewing lens that many millennials have. And again, I don't want to overgeneralize to everyone in your generation, but is there anything distinctive about what, in your view, about the way millennials think about reproductive rights and justice, think about sexuality education that may be somewhat different from Gen X baby boomers?
Yeah. You know, I think that it's such an interesting and important conversation to, you know, address these generational differences in approaching reproductive health and justice. There has really been, I think, this impulse to want to sort of say, well, you know, where are the young people? Where are the young people? You know, why don't they care? Why aren't they listening? They don't understand what it's like, you know, maybe pre Roe v. Wade, before abortion was legal. It's this sort of sense that somehow by a lack of understanding or a lack of experience, that then there's clearly a lack of credibility or a lack of ability to understand. And I think that's something that's really important to hold up about reproductive rights and justice. I think that we as a younger generation can come to hold these values and can come to stand up for justice in these ways through multiple different sources. You know, someone who takes up the issue of homelessness sometimes can arrive at, you know, why reproductive health care, comprehensive reproductive health care and abortion access is important, not because they started out being a reproductive rights activist, but because they saw the ways in which multiple systems were kind of working collaboratively to oppress an individual. And I think that that's something that we really have to leverage, actually, to deepen the conversation, as opposed to assume that because they're not raising their hands when someone says, you know, who cares about abortion rights, that that's somehow the end of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that actually this generation has a pretty complex way of thinking, and that actually we can go deeper as opposed to our maybe historic impulse of sort of remaining on the surface. You know, and I think that when we start to draw those connections and when we start to have bigger conversations about how abortion access and about how reproductive justice fits into, like, the whole picture of oppression, that actually that there's room for a really, really rich conversation there. And I think we can start to go there and that people will really be at the table.
So we've had some interesting conversations in the Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute that you are part of, and we're very happy about that. As part of the Leadership Institute, when you look out at the landscape and look at reproductive justice and faith, what do you think needs to happen, not just in the political realm, but sort of culturally and spiritually as well?
I want to say it's relevant. People are looking for a way to feel connected, whether that be spiritually or spiritual in spiritual community or in communities that would maybe not identify as spiritual. But still, I think that people are looking for some for intersections, for places where they feel a sense of welcome, a sense of belonging. And I think that our advancing technology and our, you know, sort of advancing of the ability to connect in a lot of different ways via a lot of different media are really, really amazing and actually, like, should be totally celebrated in the best possible way, that we also need to still continue to address that there are more needs than that can account for, and that there is still something really real and really spiritual about being together with people.
In terms of the work that you do every day, some of it sounds like it's pretty challenging and somewhat difficult. What's exciting to you? What gets you up in the morning?
I've kind of had this realization that, you know, being the person that I am and having had access to some of the things that I've had access growing up, you know, whether that be education or family support or community support or whatever that might be, comes actually with a lot of privilege and I think also a lot of responsibility. And not just responsibility to stand up for, you know, someone who's maybe not experienced the same opportunities or anything like that, but actually to really approach a system that is privileging some over others and to look at why that is and where there are places of empowerment and disempowerment. And I think that the thing that excites me is the opportunity to build deeper networks of support for people in even the tiniest of ways. And even though I don't claim that an abortion fund is some, that funding an abortion is somehow leading to systemic change, I think that there are ways in which we can approach abortion funding, for instance, or work directly with women that actually can start to create some systemic changes, whether that is just for them, for that one individual, but then, you know, to leverage that work to rethink the approach to how this work has historically been done, that we can actually start to build a deeper sense of commitment and that we can actually start to build a more comprehensive movement that represents the people who are being served by the work that that we want to be doing. That's what really excites me, is this opportunity to figure out ways that we can build deeper senses of support and deeper senses of that there's a network out there and that we can work in the background to make those systems as accessible as possible for individuals who are seeking them.
Well, it sounds like the work that you're doing is justice work, it's basic health care work, it's moral work, and it's building community and seeking justice for women who need it most.
That's the hope. You know,
yes.
Whether or not that always comes through every day, I don't think we can necessarily say. But I think that, you know, moving forward, that's where we want to go, and actually I think that's where we need to go. Administering services, you know, kind of for abortion funds has been happening for, you know, for quite a long time. And that's really, really important. But if we talk about bigger picture things and if we look at the systems and, you know, circumstances that have led some, put someone into this situation, how are they being supported and held by their community? What is our responsibility to kind of help in those situations? And ultimately, how do we get to a place where $100 isn't a barrier to accessing a medical procedure? where childcare and transportation isn't going to keep someone from being able to have, have the health care that they need.
Well, thank you so much, Kyle. This is just terrific, and thanks for the work that you do and for talking with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sally, and thanks for all the work that you do as well.